This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont's Public Service Department has long overseen the state's energy and telecommunications policy. Not long ago, that involved keeping tabs on telephone service and electric rates. But today, renewable energy development, the closing of Vermont Yankee, and the importance of broadband present new challenges for the department. It's been an eventful time for them lately, so today on Vermont Edition, we thought we'd go over some of the issues that have come to the department's attention with Commissioner Chris Recchia. Nice to have you back, Commissioner.
Hey, thanks, Jane, and thanks for inviting me.
So let's start with Vermont Yankee. The last time I spoke with you, I think we were talking about Vermont Yankee decommissioning with an Entergy representative as well, and you expressed the state's position that you didn't want Entergy to be able to use any money from the decommissioning fund that wasn't expressly for the purpose of decommissioning, particularly not while this fund is trying to get the money into it that it needs to do to start that decommissioning. Entergy says those expenses that it wants to do are permitted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that it can use money from that fund for the spent fuel storage. What's the issue for you that is unreasonable to you?
Right. Well, you're right, Jane. I mean, the issue is that the fund needs to grow over time. It's about $643 million right now. We need to get it up to in the $1.2 billion range. And the expenses for spent fuel management, we disagree, are not allowed by NRC. In fact, they need a waiver and exemption to do that. Now, the NRC has typically granted those, and that's one of the problems that we have with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But it is not allowed in our reading of the decommissioning fund, both the master trust agreement that we have on the fund and how the funds are established by the NRC.
The state and Entergy entered into an agreement, I think it was 15 months ago now.
Yeah, December 2013. Correct.
Okay, so so almost, more than a year ago now. Why wasn't this settled then?
It was one of the things that you may recall when Mike and I were here, we said there were some things we agreed to disagree about. This was one of them. The settlement has been very successful. It's guided the last year of the work. We have agreed on more than we disagree on, so I want to give credit to that. But the fact remains that the expenditures from the decommissioning trust fund were things that we reserved rights on because we could not agree as to what should and shouldn't be spent from there.
How big of a hurdle is this in your opinion?
Well, I think I also want to give Entergy some credit that it's less of a hurdle than it was in the sense that Entergy has agreed to fund the spent fuel expenditure of the new pad to store the dry cask storage and the canisters from a line of credit rather than taking what would have been about $143 million out of the fund. That would have been a huge fight. They have avoided that, and I appreciate that. But the fact remains that they want to take another $225 million out of the fund over time to manage that spent fuel, and it just is not a legitimate expense for the decommissioning.
So what happens then? You've asked the NRC to review this and to deny their request to use this money for spent fuel management?
Yep. At this stage, we've asked the NRC the ability to intervene and to request a hearing on it. We're also concerned with expenditures that Vermont Yankee intends to make on emergency planning and security and taxes and other things that they think are legitimately coming out of the fund that we also think need to be reviewed.
But the NRC doesn't have to agree to your request.
No, they don't. The bottom line is that the system is set up so that states have very little influence in this process. We're using the tools that we have available to us. I do think the Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Trust is different than most in the sense that ratepayers put money into this fund. Entergy has never put a dime into it. That was not expected when they bought the plant, that they weren't required to put any more money in. But the reality is that that money is of interest to Vermonters. And so we want to pay attention to that and make sure that the expenditures are for things that are really necessary and appropriate for the decommissioning. Also because Vermont ratepayers have a right to any money that might be left over in that fund. Not that there will be any, but we have the ability to focus on how that money is being spent.
An Entergy spokesman was quoted yesterday on a story here on VPR as saying that the company's plan is in line with the agreement with the state and that there's a possibility that the state's objections to the plan would further delay decommissioning and increase the costs.
I love that. What they're saying is that if we challenge this before the NRC, then expenses associated with that they think are going to come out of the decommissioning trust fund. I disagree. So stay tuned. We'll see what happens.
Because that is not a permitted use of decommissioning fund money.
Correct.
So if the NRC supports Entergy and says, yes, Entergy can use this money from the decommissioning fund, how long do you think it would delay decommissioning? Basically, how much longer would it take for that fund to be fully vested?
Right. Well, what it means is that instead of having to get about $838 million for the actual radiological decommissioning of the site, you have to add another $225 million to that. And so, you know, you're up over $1 billion at that point. So it makes a significant difference. How fast the fund grows, of course, depends on the investments that the trustee has. It's been doing very well. When I started this job 2.5 years ago, it was about $518 million, and it got up to $650. Entergy has taken $12 million out of the fund for decommissioning planning, which is a legitimate expenditure, and we're happy that they're moving ahead with that. But we're concerned about some of these other larger expenditures.
I'm talking right now with Chris Recchia. He's the commissioner of Vermont's Public Service Department. His department has a hand in a lot of things that you probably have an interest in, including renewable energy projects, broadband and cell phone coverage in Vermont, Fairpoint Communications. The strike has really affected Fairpoint. The strike is over, but service problems still remain. We're going to talk about that. And right now, we're talking about the decommissioning of Vermont Yankee. So listeners, if you have any questions on these subjects or things that are important to you that the Public Service Department is looking at, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Commissioner Recchia, before we leave Vermont Yankee, are there any other issues that you see with decommissioning that we should be talking about?
Well, I think Vermont has a strong interest in maintaining the emergency planning zone at the plant for at least through the time the fuel is in the spent fuel pool, which will be another 5 years, hopefully completed by 2020. And, you know, I think there is a fundamental difference between fuel in an active system that requires management and when it's in dry cask, which will be a more passive system. And I think that Vermonters expect us to be able to continue the emergency planning drills and the environmental monitoring associated with that during that time.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about the state's renewable energy portfolio and some legislation that's moving right now through the House. H. Bill 40 would align the state's renewable energy credits or RECs program with other states so that utilities can continue to sell their renewable energy credits outside of Vermont. And it requires electric utilities to cut carbon emissions in Vermont. This new legislation would set standards for renewable portfolio goals for Vermont utilities, and it until now has been a voluntary program, so this would make it mandatory. Mm-hmm. I find this bill very confusing. Can you explain it a little bit better?
Yes, I'll try and do it in a simple, relatively simple form, but it is a complicated bill. Let me start with the big picture, which is that 29 states around the nation have a renewable portfolio standard. Vermont chose not to do that, but instead to have a program that encouraged renewable development that's called the SPEED program. And we have been very successful at developing renewable projects. We did not require that the credits be counted here in Vermont, and so they've been able to be sold elsewhere. What that means is that Vermont has been participating in the market as a seller but not as a buyer. And now what this bill does is say, okay, rather than just become the 30th state with a renewable portfolio standard, we wanted to really leverage this and really have an innovative program that the governor announced in his address, State of the State address, to really bring Vermont into the forefront on this area. And one of the ways we're doing that is by taking advantage of the renewables that are already built here, but also providing incentives to build new ones. So there are three tiers associated with this, which is where some of the confusion comes in. Tier one is basically using the existing projects that we have on the books and requiring that that utilities buy and retire renewable credits for those facilities. But they can sell the what I'll call the higher value credits and buy lower value credits and arbitrage that difference and save ratepayers a significant amount of money in the process. And that is what Burlington Electric and Washington Electric are doing now. They are 100% renewable, but they're taking the renewable credits from their projects, say the McNeil biomass plant, selling those to Southern New England at considerably more than what they buy hydro credits for and make that difference. So that's one component. And then another is that moving forward, we want to provide an incentive for people to continue with distributed generation, to be able to transfer those credits to the utilities if they wish to and have the utilities retire those credits. So all the net metering projects that have occurred, we would expect that type of thing to occur.
When you say retire those credits, meaning they can't then continue to sell those on?
Correct. Okay. They would not be able to continue to sell those on. They would have those as part of their portfolio obligations.
But they would have purchase them from the energy producers who would be the individuals who have, say, the solar panels.
Exactly. And right now they are paying a premium for the benefit. They're just not using those RECs in any particular way. They're not selling those, but they're also not retiring them. This would then have them retire them. And then a third tier is unique, and this is what I mean about kind of leapfrogging ahead of the RPSs. The third tier is to look at all a customer's energy needs and say, are there things that the utility can do to help that are more cost effective than even, let's say, building a new renewable project? Weatherization, efficiency, heat pumps, things like that that would actually save a customer in their overall energy bill. And yet, you know, it may increase the amount of electricity that a customer uses, but it would reduce their bill and carbon footprint overall. And I'm thinking of primarily the way we heat our homes, oil, or transportation, providing electric car charging stations and encouraging electric car use. So in those areas, we think this program will actually save Vermonters about $248 million in energy costs over its lifetime and when it's fully implemented, and help us achieve our carbon goals as well as our renewable goals.
When you talk about those savings, are those just isolated savings that you see it will save Vermonters, what did you say, $248 million? But you said that associated with that, their use of electricity could go up, so they might be paying more for electricity. So that doesn't cancel itself out.
It's a net. The 248 was net, anticipating that the savings would outweigh the costs. Yes.
So how would they actually do that? I mean, is my utility going to come to me and say, hey, Jane, we're going to help you buy an electric car?
They might. They might say, Jane, you know, what we're willing to do is put on bill financing and give you a very low interest rate if you buy a car, an electric car. Or they might say, we're going to provide free charging stations and sponsor electric charging. There may be a variety of ways of doing that. They might also come to you and say, Jane, we notice you live in this beautiful old farmhouse that's kind of leaky, and you know, we think if you weatherize it, we can save you, you know, 30% on your oil bill, and you know, finance that on their bill or finance that through their program. So there are a variety of ways they can do it, but utilities are in a great place to work with their customers to provide this level of service.
Doesn't that change what a utility is, though?
I don't know. I think that some of the utilities are doing that now. Green Mountain Power has been very innovative about reaching out to people and trying to be a customer to them. We have an energy efficiency utility. You know, Efficiency Vermont is a utility and the first in the country to be a regulated utility with a public purpose. So I think it's just an extension and modernization of the old model, but it's definitely different than the old model.
Yeah, we're talking with Public Service Department Commissioner Chris Recchia right now about changes that the state is likely to make to how we deal with the renewable energy portfolio standards in Vermont. And making some changes to our utilities. If you have a question on that, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Let's clarify a couple other things in this bill. So the way I understand it is if Vermont doesn't make changes right now, Vermont utilities won't be able to sell those credits out in other states. And that would be a huge hit for Vermont utilities and would increase the price that customers pay pretty significantly.
Yeah, that is one of the risks. I'll say that just to try and explain this clearly and briefly. As I described, our program was not about renewable energy credits. It was about development of renewables, and we were successful in doing that. Unfortunately, some of the states that are buying the renewable energy credits are looking at that and saying, Vermont is double counting. They're claiming they are, have all these renewable power, and but they are actually selling the RECs, and the attribute of doing that means you can't claim that that power is renewable any longer for yourself. I understand that, but that has not been the case. We have not said we've said we've had renewable development, but we haven't said that we're claiming those renewable power electrons, if you will, for ourselves. So that is a confusion. Connecticut is in the process of doing a hearing on this, and they have not made a decision. But if they were to think that Vermont was double counting and disallow our RECs, it would be an immediate 6% rate increase across the board. And some of the utilities would be hit in the 20% range. This is about $50 million a year worth of renewable energy credits that are sold. So it's very significant. This bill solves that problem and takes
You're
away
sure
any
about
doubt.
That.
Yes, we are 100% sure because we've checked with those other other states to make sure that this accomplishes the goal of solving that question.
And how does it change what Vermont utilities will now need to have in terms of new renewable energy developments?
Right. So over time, the requirement increases. Right now, about 45% of the electric grid is renewable and counts as that. So that's kind of the tier one. And because that is already established and we don't want to impact the projects that are already underway, we're just increasing that slowly until 2017. And then the standard goes up to 55%, and that's a tier two new work that needs to be done in order to meet tier two. And then eventually in 2050, it goes up, 2032, it goes up to 75%. And at that point, I imagine a lot of tier three, meaning the home weatherizations and things like that, would also kick in. So it does increase over time, and it is aggressive, and it puts Vermont in a leadership position in this. But it does so in a way that is very sensitive to rates, and we think ultimately results in a rate decrease for consumers.
So we got a note from Annette Smith who says, with the new renewable energy legislation requiring a minimum of 250 megawatts of new solar every year, what does Commissioner Recchia propose to do about the siting problem? So where we're going to put these projects?
So I think we are looking at ways to encourage and provide incentives for people to put these facilities in places where communities want them, things like industrial parks or landfills. There are already projects that are underway to try and advance those things. And I think that providing an incentive to developers to look at those places and for communities to identify those places will help as we roll this out.
We're talking today with Public Service Department Commissioner Chris Recchia. And if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking a little bit about the state's renewable energy goals. You can ask a question about that. We're also going to move on to talk a little bit about broadband internet. We're going to talk about cell service, what the state has control over, what it doesn't. And as well, we're going to look at Fairpoint issues. We may also have time to get into some questions about Vermont gas and the pipeline project. Again, if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're checking in with the head of Vermont's Public Service Department. Commissioner Chris Recchia has been telling us about continuing to look at the Vermont Yankee decommissioning issues and renewable energy problems and concerns and new legislation that's pending. And now we're going to explore other things that have come to the attention of the department, like broadband internet expansion and problems at Fairpoint Communications. If you have questions about anything that's coming before the Public Service Department that they are looking at, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Brian, who's calling in from Danby. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just curious about the solar farms that I've seen going up. I had heard from somebody that they don't have to follow the normal Act 250 process. Is that correct?
Right, right. In Vermont, we have kind of two paths that projects can follow. There's the Act 250 process that most of us are familiar with for land use applications, and then there's the Section 248 process of the statutes that deals with any electrical generation that's connected to the grid. So once when a solar project is proposed, it is under Section 248, but that does include all the environmental criteria for Act 250, and actually, if you ask the board, the Public Service Board that rules on this, they would say they actually have broader authorities to look at siting issues and environmental issues associated with projects under 248 than you would have under 250.
Brian, does that satisfy your question?
I guess I'm wondering, are they like taking it by eminent domain or?
Right, and the solar projects and stuff that you see are not using eminent domain, but utility line projects like the pipeline or transmission lines, things like that, can use eminent domain once they have a certificate of public good from the Public Service Board. It's rarely used, but you certainly have probably heard about it in the context of the Vermont Gas project.
Let's go to Sylvester in Brattleboro. Hi, Sylvester. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the question, have you looked at the combined carbon footprint for these wind towers and solar panels that to replace the 600 megawatts that we've lost from Vermont Yankee closing?
Yep, good question. So first of all, to clarify on Vermont Yankee, we have not bought power from Vermont Yankee. None of the Vermont utilities have purchased power from them since 2012. And so there is no change in the last few years as a result of Vermont Yankee closing with respect to that. But your main point about looking at the total carbon footprint of all these technologies is a good one, and we do look at that. We try and look at the life cycle impacts, not just the emissions from facilities. You may have often heard that, you know, you buy an electric car, well, that's great, except for that if your electricity is produced by coal plants, you're really not solving the problem. So we really have to look at the full life cycle and make sure that, you know, we understand what the carbon implications are of solar panel manufacturing, transportation, installation, maintenance. Same with wind projects, to make sure that we understand that. But then also you do then get a benefit in state of, you know, reducing carbon emissions, but it all needs to be taken into account.
And what are you finding so far in that comparison?
Right. We are finding still that, you know, both wind and solar and hydro and biomass, and we can talk a little bit about that if you want in terms of sustainably harvested biomass. But if you are doing that you are improving by far carbon reductions over the fossil fuel alternatives, regardless of what they are.
But Vermont Yankee nuclear power wasn't fossil.
That was not fossil fuel, right. You know, I know that people want to promote nuclear as an alternative and a significant one to deal with carbon and the carbon challenges we have. And you're right that the carbon emissions are zero or near zero because you have manufacturing and all the other life cycle costs associated with it that I was talking about. But the reality is that until the waste problem is solved, this is not going to be an option for, I think, the United States, let alone Vermont. The waste problem is very significant. You've got tens of thousands of years of responsibility for something that is giving you power for 40 or years. And that, I think, is an unfortunate choice of, you know, the current or current generation imposing on future generations. And until it's solved, I'm not willing to look at it as a as an option.
So the carbon comparison is sort of a moot point for you because you don't think that's a viable option for Vermont because of the storage issues.
Yes, that's correct.
We're talking with Chris Recchia. He's the commissioner of the Public Service Department. We have a quick follow-up from Annette Smith, who asked a question about solar siting. Mm-hmm. She says, that didn't answer my question. There is nothing in H-40, the bill that's currently in front of the legislature, about incentives for siting. So what's he talking about specifically?
Well, there is a whole restructuring of net metering and these programs before the Public Service Board. There's rulemaking required where that would be addressed.
Let's move on to some questions about internet service, cell phone service, telecommunications, which was kind of the old purview of the Public Service Department more so than it is today, but it's still something that you have to deal with. Bill is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Chris, regarding Burlington Telecom and local input into that, is there a role for a local person or persons to be part of the policy-making body, the body which might be a purchaser of Burlington Telecom. Is my question clear?
Yeah, I think so, because I understand that there are many Burlington Telecom customers who really have consumer loyalty to Burlington Telecom and want to see that continued as a community asset, and I get that. So the way I would answer this is to say I think that options are on the table to do that. Obviously, Mayor Weinberg has been negotiating the deal that resulted in agreement with the debtors and kind of got us moving on this project, and the Public Service Board has approved it. One of the issues for us, and we're seeing it in other places around the state as well, is that a municipal government that wants to take responsibility for these or have this as a public service needs to really be clear. There is a law that says you cannot impose costs on that onto taxpayers. And unfortunately, that's what happened in Burlington, and we're trying to extricate ourselves from that problem. So it would be really important to me to ensure that safeguards were in place that that could never happen again, not in Burlington and not elsewhere. That said, I think and also you're dealing with a very competitive business in Chittenden County. You've got cable, you've got fiber, you've got Burlington Telecom, you've got DSL and a variety of other services. So it's going to get harder, not easier, to make money in that. And we feel that risk is best borne by the private sector and not by the public sector.
All right. If you have a question about something in telecommunications, if you want to talk about cell service, maybe you don't have it. Right. If you want to talk about broadband internet and what that actually means these days, because now the federal guidelines for broadband are different from what the state has been trying to get to in terms of last mile coverage, you can call 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Jason, who's calling in from Bethel. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering what the state of Vermont intends to do about sporadic cell service and internet service. I live in Bethel, and I don't have either at my house. They put up a cell tower, and apparently it's for AT&T customers only. I feel like my kids are at a disadvantage just because of where I live.
Jason,
I was promised by Governor Shumlin that this was going to change if we elected him.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. And we should probably split those two things up, cell coverage internet coverage. But Jason doesn't have either.
Right. And Jason, if it's any consolation, I live up the road in Randolph and can relate. But Let me start with the distinctions that you just raised, Jane, because it's really important to understand that the Federal Communications FCC, the Federal Communications boy, now I'm blanking on the last syllable, but anyway, the FCC, I'll call them
Commission. Right?
Commission, of course. Thank you. They regulate wireless services. The state of Vermont cannot do that. We can only regulate the typical phone service, hardline phone service that has traditionally been in our purview. And when you so you start with that distinction that we have no authority over wireless companies, and then you add on to that the internet conundrum, which is we also the FCC regulates that. And we're not able to regulate that either on the phone line or in wireless territory. Now, I can talk about how that's changing in a minute, but let's start with that and say that, you know, Governor Shumlin met his commitment to try and to provide broadband and solutions for every household in Vermont at a time when broadband was considered to be 768 kilobytes per second download and 168 kilobytes per second upload.
Did you say he met his promise or he made his promise?
He met his promise with a handful of exceptions at the end of 2013.
Although my understanding of his promise was that, you know, no exceptions. We're going to have last mile coverage.
Yeah, okay. Fine, but we have solutions in hand for those remaining ones, and we're waiting for VTEL to finish their rollout of their system that will get to those last few.
Although I will just say, we're already over a year beyond when it was supposed to happen.
As is that project. You're right. A lot of our reliance was based on the VTEL work that was supposed to be done by the end of 2013, and they got an extension from the federal government to 2015, and there wasn't much we could do about that. But that said, now rolling backwards to the issue, you know, since that time, broadband became FCC decided that 4 megabytes per second download and 1 megabyte per second upload was the new standard. And so we've started trying to roll that out. And then on top of that, they're now about to change that to 25 megabytes per second and 3, so 25.3. And the legislature last year put a goal in the statutes of 100-100. And 100-100 is fastest speed that is available. Well, actually, there's faster speeds available, but the technology is basically fiber to the home is what gets you to that. So now we're refocusing through the new telecommunications plan all our efforts on those underserved places that don't have fast speeds to try and figure out how best to spend what limited resources there are to get fiber optic really to those places. And that's even harder than telephone line to the last mile. So we're working on it, but there should be, you know, broadband's going to continue to change. And in an unregulated environment, what we have is to cajole private companies to develop into those hard to reach areas. And that's really hard to make an economic case for.
Does the FCC's recent decision on net neutrality give you more power to regulate broadband providers?
It starts. I'll say that those who don't like that decision would call it the camel's nose under the tent. And I would say that I am the camel's nose. that is fair. It really is solely addressing net neutrality, but we haven't actually seen the actual order yet to see what regulations the FCC intends to apply, what it intends to exempt the providers from, what it intends to allow the states to do. So I don't know at this point. But what I can say is it's a very significant decision to say that it is now a Title II service like telephone, meaning, you know, it is a required service that is expected to be provided to all Americans. So I am hopeful that over time we will get to be able to do more, particularly in terms of service quality. I don't think we're ever going to be regulating price on those services because there is so much competition in core areas. But for that last mile, we need some more tools.
Let's go to Adam in Burlington. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was calling to ask about your point on private versus public-based broadband service. You mentioned that the taxpayer element of it makes it largely unfeasible compared to a private market. But that said, countries that have public broadband or the private competitive broadband access tend to have both vastly cheaper broadband service and vastly faster. Aside from this, you were mentioning that it's hard to convince private corporations to expand into certain areas, which seems like something that public-based broadband service that makes use of its natural monopoly could do much more effectively. I was wondering what your thoughts were on this.
Yeah, and just in case people couldn't hear Adam's phone line, it was a little bit crackly. I think Adam is asking about moving internet service providers into the public sector rather than relying on the private sector to do this, given what we've just been talking about.
Right, right. Well, I agree with you, Adam, in a couple of respects. One is that you know, when we were doing rural electrification or rural telephony, we made the effort to make that a public policy and to provide funding to try and do that. That, unfortunately, is not the case now. The resources – this is all about resources and availability. And if you went to the European examples that you were describing, the tax structure is much higher in order to pay for those things, and that we just have not had the appetite in the United States to do that. And so I'm afraid Vermont is not in a position to really drive that, other than to participate at the FCC wherever possible to encourage the fact that these are essential services.
Commissioner Recchia, I want to ask you one question about Fairpoint Communications before we go,
yes.
But I'll also read a note from our listener, Jim, who writes in to say, Commissioner Recchia speaks dismissively of just a few people without broadband internet, but so many of my rural neighbors have only dial-up or limited bandwidth. High-speed internet is still a dream for many of us Vermonters. So just quickly on the Fairpoint situation. Fairpoint workers in Vermont and Maine were on strike for 5 months. They are now not on strike. They've reached an agreement over contract details with the company. During that strike, there were a lot of service delays that really vexed customers, including a 911 service outage that the Public Service Board is still looking into. It's
right.
Also looking into some of those service delays. The service delay issue has now gone back to pre-strike levels. Is that satisfactory?
No. We started a service quality investigation before the strike in July of last year. July to October, to give you a sense, July to October last year, we had about 70 complaints, which we felt were too high. Between October 15th, the strike, and when the strike ended, we had 1,600 complaints. All of which I want to give credit to my staff, the consumer affairs group, really just doubled down and tried to help everybody they could. And we got all of those resolved. But it was not acceptable service quality before the strike. And it is now even better than pre-strike levels, but still not quite acceptable. You know,
So what do you do?
We have been first of all, there are two pieces to this. One is for my staff and the department, we continue to meet with Fairpoint weekly and talk with them every other day about where they are on this process and how many service people they have in state and what they are prioritizing. Definitely giving priority to people who have no cell service and who also have medical conditions and things like that. But we're also still pursuing the service quality investigation with the Public Service Board, and that is underway. At the end of all this, I expect this company to be an exemplary customer service company, and that's my goal. And wish me luck.
All right. That's Chris Recchia. He's the commissioner of Vermont's Public Service Department. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We are finally coming out of the deep freeze we were in for pretty much all of February. 43 days below freezing in some parts of the state, 5-degree averages in Montpelier and Rutland. But there are going to be some casualties of the cold weather, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Foresters in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee are expressing excitement that a big forest pest, the hemlock woolly adelgid, may have been felled by the frigid temps. So what about here in Vermont? Are we seeing damaging invasive die-offs? To find out, we are checking in now with Jim Esden, a forester in Vermont's Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. We've actually pulled him out of a forestry conference he's attending in Maine. So, Jim, thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, I'm glad to do it. Thank you for having me.
Cold temperatures are pretty common in Vermont, as we all know, and most of the plant and animal life around here has developed ways to adapt to cold winters. But some species do die off in really cold weather. How cold does it have to be for the hemlock woolly adelgid to die off?
Oh, boy, you're starting with the hard question.
Why not?
Yeah. There are several variables in the equation, and one of them has to do with just how cold it actually gets. But some of the other variables include how quickly the temperature changes, how long it stays down very low, and very important, when that cold snap occurs in the insect's life history. As they mature and approach egg-bearing age, they begin to lose some of their cold hardiness. And this winter's cold has been close to optimal in all three of those areas, and so we've experienced between 97% and 99% of the insects that were active through the early winter have been killed by this cold that we've had this winter.
So not just the adelgid, but all insects you're talking about there.
Oh, forgive me. I when I said insects, I meant the adelgid.
Okay, so but in the 90s, you think of the adelgids that were active at the beginning of the winter may have been killed off. The sad part is we're not getting rid of them completely. So can you talk a little bit about the asexual reproduction and how tenacious they are?
Yeah, that's part of what makes hemlock woolly adelgids so invasive, is that they have two generations each year. The winter generation is the one that's experienced this high mortality rate, but even if one or two survive, because they reproduce asexually, all of the adelgids are females, and they bear eggs that don't need to be fertilized. So even if just one survives, she will bear eggs, and the next generation will begin to recover from the high mortality rate we experienced this winter.
The hemlock woolly adelgid is in Vermont, but it's not widespread throughout the state yet. It's mostly down in southern Vermont. So could this winter's cold temperatures at least stop or slow its spread?
We really believe that is what's happening, that the cold winter temperatures are slowing down the rate of spread, and also slowing down the amount of time that it would take for a tree to succumb. We actually haven't yet seen tree mortality. We are beginning to see trees that are showing signs of decline, but we haven't really attributed tree mortality directly to hemlock woolly adelgid yet.
So how worried should we be for the state's hemlock trees, given that you have not yet seen tree mortality due to this invasive pest?
Well, because hemlock trees are so valuable as a foundation species, I think it's something to be very concerned with.
You're also worried about another pest that affects the hemlocks, and you describe this pest and the adelgid together as sort of a 1-2 punch. And I hadn't heard about this before. It's the elongate hemlock scale. So when you have both of them on a tree, it's really damaging?
That's correct. Yeah, they both damage the tree. They feed on different parts of the tree, but combined, they can put particular stress on trees.
And is there any way to deal with either of these at this point?
Well, yeah, keep praying for cold weather. there are some things that we can do. The big thing is to try to just keep the trees as free of other stresses as possible. Healthy trees seem to be able to endure the stresses that the adelgid or the scale insect put on the trees. So for those that have, say, a tree in the backyard, if you can water it during times of drought, if you can raise the lawnmower so that the blades don't cut the roots as you mow your lawn, those kind of things can give trees a little bit of an extra help. If a tree becomes infested, there are, for those that are of the persuasion to use insecticides, there are some very effective chemical insecticides. There's one that's actually an organic material that is approved for use in Vermont. And there are some things on the horizon, biological controls. There are some predatory beetles that we've released in three different sites in Vermont. And then there are some fungi that are actually native organisms that are still being, they're still being experimented with, but they've been shown to kill hemlock woolly adelgid.
Huh.
And some researchers at UVM are trying to figure out how to introduce those to infested branches in a way that, you know, is practical.
Jim, we only have like literally 10 seconds, but I just want to ask you quickly if we're seeing any die-offs from ticks. This is now considered a human pest. Cold can affect ticks, but snow cover can help insulate them. So any chance we're going to see fewer ticks this year?
Well, I'm not a tick expert, but my guess is that we had so much snow that most of them will be fairly well insulated from the brutal cold. And my suspicion is that we will have a normal tick year.
Well, that's a disappointing way to end the segment. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Well, I wish I had better news, but
Jim Esden. Jim is a forester with the Vermont Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that will wrap up today's show. Tomorrow, we are going to be in a chili frenzy. The Vermont Chili Festival is this Saturday in Middlebury. But tomorrow, we're going to have chefs and foodies on the show who can help you make an outstanding pot of chili. We're going to tackle all of the questions you've ever had, like should you use ketchup, add beans, fresh chilies, or powders. Plus, we'll be having our very own VPR chili cook-off. You don't want to miss it, so tune in tomorrow at noon. And thanks for listening today.